Russia's economy is declining, even as Russia's assertiveness is increasing. Russia would be so much more attractive if it was aspiring to be a superpower for peace and freedom and prosperity. It was trying to be a superpower for ideas and for values, instead of trying to recreate the lost glories of Tsarism or the old Soviet Union.
Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott expressing his displeasure with Vladimir Putin. Abbott is reportedly fuming that the Russian president brought along a few warships to this weekend's G20 economic summit in Brisbane. Coming up, we'll get the latest from Ukraine, where it appears the Russian president is also preparing to restart hostilities there. But first, here at home, bias in the LAPD. An internal report says many officers think the department's disciplinary system is unfair. The police department started looking into the issue after former officer Christopher Dorner went on a killing rampage in early 2013 and wrote a manifesto about bias in the department. The report was released this morning. LA Times reporter Joel Rubin covers the department for The Times, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks, Madam. Good to be here.
Well, nice to have you. And part of the report is a survey of employees, 500 or so, and many of them say bias plays into the disciplinary system. How so?
Well, you're right. Yeah, it was that is sort of the centerpiece of this report. When the department announced plans to take a good look at their discipline system, they said, you know, we want to hear from the officers themselves, and so they set out to seek and get their input. And the result was this computer survey where officers were able to anonymously share their thoughts on various questions about the discipline system. And one of the big theme that came out of that was the sense that officers, or many officers, certainly not all, there were some in the minority who thought it was fair and well run, but certainly the predominant theme was this idea that we don't think it is a system where we can feel confident that we're going to get a fair shake. And the major aspect of that was having to do with different ranks of officers. The lower rank in regular rank and file police officers felt like the higher ranking officers, the command staff, you know, get a break, get an easy go of it when it comes to misconduct. While the lower ranking officers often get the book thrown at them. So, you know, the same type of misconduct is handled differently depending on where you are in the totem pole.
And so it didn't have much to do with race or sex. It was mainly rank.
Well, that was the one that came through loud and clear, and I should clarify that I was able to obtain copies of hundreds of pages of the raw comments from the officers. So that was not part of the report, but I was able to get them. So my assessment, my comments here are based on having read through the raw comments. In the report itself, they mention rank. They certainly mention rank as being one of the issues. They mention gender and race, and those were also questions that were asked, you know, to the officers. Do they think that race and gender and other issues play a role? And in reading through the officers' comments, those two issues come through much less loudly than the rank issue did. Certainly there were some who felt like there were disparities based on those two, but not nearly as much as the rank.
And there are also accusations regarding the disciplinary panels that instead of being actual hearings, the chief expects the commanding officers to find officers guilty. Is that right?
Yeah, there was a lot of talk in the officers' comments and about it's called the Board of Rights. That is a three-person panel that when you've done something really serious as an officer, and the department feels that it is something that is so bad that you should be fired, they, instead of punishing you, they send you to this Board of Rights, because under the rules, if you are going to be fired, it has to be a Board of Rights that does so, not the department itself. And there was a lot of discussion amongst the officers about this process and how they thought it was unfair for various reasons. But one issue in particular is this idea that under Chief Beck, he's made little secret of the fact that if he thinks you should be fired, he's going to send you to a Board of Rights. The problem that some see is that those Board of Rights are manned or womaned by two LAPD command staff, captains or above, and a third is a civilian who's brought in. And those those captains or commanders, the thinking goes, feel the pressure of doing what their chief wants them to do, that is fire the officer, and so that they have to struggle with having an independent assessment of whether the officer should be fired or not, or whether they should do what the chief has said he wants them to do. There's some lawsuits pending right now to that effect where captains have sued the department saying they felt like they were retaliated against when they decided not to fire an officer. Beck, of course, would say that he does not expect the boards to do what he says he wants. He wants them to be independent. It's just that he feels like if you've done something so bad that you should be fired, that he's going to send them to the board.
Mm-hmm. So is this new under Chief Charlie Beck, or has this been a system that officers have complained about for many, many years?
That's a great question. I think it's important to point out that these are perennial complaints and issues that have long, been heard in the department. Nobody likes to be punished, and nobody's ever going to say this is a perfect system for discipline. And so a lot of these issues that came up are issues that have been in place before Beck was chief, and they'll be in place after Beck was is no longer chief. But I think what's important is that the discipline system has really become one of Beck's big albatrosses, and it has taken on a real sense of momentum that can't be ignored, which is one of the reasons why he announced doing this report in the first place, because there was this, whether it's perception or reality, throughout the ranks, people feel like they don't get a fair shake in the discipline system, and that is taking on a life of its own.
And then you write that there is also underlying this a deep-seated sense of alienation felt towards the higher ranks.
Yeah, that was something that I was really struck by reading through the officers' comments. It's just this sense, and again, I don't think it's anything particularly new to Beck's tenure as chief, but it might be a bit more severe. It's just the sense that the lower-ranking rank-and-file patrol officers really came through loud and clear that a lot of them just don't think the command staff have really any sense of or appreciation of what it means to be a boot out in the street, so to speak, to be what it means to be dealing day in and day out with the realities of patrol in Los Angeles, and there was a sense of disdain and sort of cynicism of they just don't get it.
Yeah, and it seems a little shocking or sad or I don't know what, that it took the killing rampage of Christopher Dorner to convene this kind of assessment of what's happening in the rank and file.
Yeah, and you definitely heard that in the comments too, where there were people saying, why did, just what you said, why did it take Dorner to get us to this point where we're having this conversation? And then a lot of cynicism and sort of jadedness about what really is going to come out of this. They're just going to let us vent in this survey, and then nothing's going to come of it. And I think the department knew they had to do something about it, and we're seeing the results of it today in this report. The fact that it took so long to come out, I think, only reinforced that sense of cynicism amongst the officers.
Well, Joel, thanks.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Joel Rubin covers the LAPD for the LA Times. Well, as our drought drags on, city officials struck a deal today that could save 3 billion gallons of water a year. For more than a decade, Los Angeles has poured water into the mostly dried up Owens Lake, 200 miles northeast of here. The water stops huge amounts of dust from blowing out of that lake bed and polluting the air. It's also a kind of penance paid by LA for diverting the Owens River away from the lake in the first place 100 years ago. You remember the story of Mulholland and the aqueduct. But now, after years of negotiations, water officials in LA and the Owens Valley have agreed on an alternative plan for controlling that dust. Great Basin Unified Air Pollution Control Officer Ted Shady joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, you have fought the DWP over this for many years. You have been personally vilified, sued by the DWP for demanding too much in terms of dust control. So how do you feel about this deal?
I'm thrilled. I've been working on the Owens Lake project for 24 years. And, today, for the very first time, we have an agreement that I feel is going to help us finish the job of controlling the dust.
So what changed?
Quite honestly, the city administration, Mayor Garcetti and DWP Commissioner Mel Levine and his and the senior DWP staff, they got pointed in a different direction. They decided to try to reach an agreement rather than try to solve things through litigation. The previous administration was sure that if they threw enough lawyers at the problem, that they would get what they needed, but that just didn't pan out for them. And Mayor Garcetti identified this as one of his major issues to resolve, and dedicated, you know, directed his commissioners and his DWP staff to work with us. So, and in addition, we've developed some different techniques. That's really the thing that allows this to move ahead. We are tilling areas of the lake bed rather that were formerly flooded with water. But those areas, although they're tilled, and the large dirt clods, the large clods will keep the dust from emitting. But we know that over time those clods will deteriorate. But because these were areas that were previously flooded, we have the infrastructure in place that allows us to put a blast of water over that area, reset the clods, and then till it again. So it'll be a kind of a cycle of an area that's tilled, and then when the tilling breaks down, it'll get flooded. And you know, we expect the water use to be reduced very significantly.
Okay, I'm going to bring in someone else to tell us more about this. Marty Adams, second in command in charge of water at the LADWP. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, tell us more about how this will work. Ted mentioned dirt clods and tilling, and can you paint a picture for us?
Yes. So what we're going to be doing is we're actually almost like they till a farm. We're going to do the same thing, but on a much grander scale with much bigger equipment on the Owens Lake bed. And as Ted said, in the area where we have ponds. So we know that we have the ability to reflood if an area becomes emissive, but that gives us an opportunity to take large plows and large grading equipment and create this series of furrows, almost as if we're Jack and the Beanstalk planting giant beans. But in this case, we're turning over giant clods of earth almost the size of your torso in really deep troughs, and that'll stop the velocity of the wind crossing the surface, and it's that velocity of the wind that stirs the dust up. So we do believe this is a great way ahead. It'll save a lot of water, it'll be fast to implement, and it'll save a lot of money as well. So we think it's a win all the way around.
Is this going to save LA ratepayers money?
It will definitely be reflected on the water bills. Part of the water bill is a rate pass-through for water that we have to purchase. And so when we leave a lot of water on Owens Lake for dust control, we have to pay to replace that water with very expensive water. So as we leave less water on the lake, we'll have to purchase less water. And that also means that water is then freed up for other people in California, because most of that water that we replace right now comes from the California Delta.
How much water does LA send to the Owens Lake?
So we actually had some high years where we were sending about 80 or 85,000 acre feet a year, which is about the water use of San Francisco. In the last couple years, we've been able to do some conservation measures to get that down to about 70,000 acre feet of water. It's still a tremendous amount of water that's going out there. So we believe that by using this process in coordination with Great Basin and making sure that it's implemented correctly and works correctly, that we can probably reduce about 30,000 of that 70 that we're putting out there right now.
So about half, basically.
Yeah, very close to half, yes.
And when will that start?
We hope to start as soon as we can this winter. One of the challenges is we're in dust season now. So if we dry up, we have to dry the ponds up to be able to get the equipment in there, and it's pretty dense mud and clay, which is why it works in this kind of soil. And so with a little bit of logistics, we have to make sure we can get it dried down, and as we dry it down, not cause dust emissions, because this is the windy season. So we'll work closely with Great Basin staff on this, but we'll start implementing as fast as we can, probably start kind of slowly feathering it in as we can take those ponds out of service and start the work on the ground. We hope that, and then of course we'll probably ramp up substantially this summertime when we can really draw the ponds down.
And Ted Shady, is this the end then of the litigation, the two decades worth plus of litigation?
I think it is. You know, it gives Great Basin we are assured of getting to control on the lake bed through this agreement, and that is what we needed. And DWP finally has a known maximum amount that they'll ever be liable for, and we've got these techniques now to save water and money. You know, I think there's not much left to fight about. I expect nothing but cooperation over the next couple of years, and within the next couple of years, we will be in attainment. We will have solved the problem.
Wow. Okay. So truly remarkable.
I totally agree with Ted, is that this should conclude that era, and we should be moving ahead together at this point.
All right. Marty Adams, second in command for water at the L.A. Department of Water and Power, and Ted Shady, the Great Basin Unified Air Pollution Control Officer. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up on the program, sexual abuse in youth competitive swimming. An investigation finds widespread abuse by coaches of young swimmers. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Olympic swimmer and coach Jack Nelson died last week. He was famous for coaching the U.S. women's 400-meter relay team that beat the heavily favored East Germans at the 1976 Olympics. But he was also accused by one of his star athletes, Diana Nyad, of raping her multiple times, starting when she was 14 years old. Diana Nyad talked about it on one of her KCRW sports commentaries back in 2010.
I was terrified, I was humiliated, I was confused, and I can tell you that I had no earthly concept of just how deep the imprint would burn, how long the emotional ramifications would endure.
Diana Nyad is not alone. It's been reported that more than 100 swimming coaches have been banned from the sport for life because of sexual abuse allegations or convictions. An article in Outside Magazine this week takes an in-depth look at the issue. The reporter is Rachel Sturtz, and she joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks, Madeline.
Well, you begin your article by telling the story of a young swimmer in Western Massachusetts. Tell us a little bit about her.
Her name is Anna Stremko, and she was kind of the typical swimmer, where she got started really young and became competitive really young. You know, swimming is a sport where, you know, you can be 12, 13, 14 beginning. You can start to look towards the Olympics. And when she was 13 years old, her coach called her in for a meeting that summer as they were heading into the next season. And at the end of that conversation, he pulled her into a storage room and raped her.
And her story has some common points with a number of other cases you talk about. She doesn't say anything to anyone for a long time, so there's no physical evidence. And the local swimming community then, you know, when she makes her allegations known, does not rally around her.
Yeah, and that's unfortunately very, very typical. I think, you know, with any sex offender, but especially in sports, for whatever reason, you know, coaches have this powerful sway over parents, over athletes, and especially coaches who groom these athletes to get them to the point where they know that they won't say anything. They've usually also groomed the parents. So the parents trust them. They have them over to their barbecues. And, you know, there's a reason why when sex offenders are caught, you know, people are always saying, oh, he was a great coach. He would have never done anything. He never touched my child. And that has more to say about the manipulativeness of that person, you know. And so, yeah, a lot of people came to his support and kind of left the family alone.
Yeah. And so it's reminiscent of, well, we remember what happened at Penn State and where the coach was much beloved and of course, the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And do you see some parallels between what's happened with the Catholic Church and this scandal as you've reported it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things that I realized early on and the difference between the church and, let's say, a school besides, you know, these youth competitive sports, you know, in church you can be pious without a priest. In school you can be intelligent without a teacher. But for whatever reason, sports have this link between the coach and the athlete. And the athlete's success is often attributed to the coach. So you have this power dynamic that's even stronger than what you've seen in the past with the Catholic Church. Then with Penn State, those parallels are obviously with, you know, the covering up and adults not knowing what to do with the situation, instead silencing it.
And is there something particular about swimming?
Well, you know, there is. You know, I spoke with Celia Brackenridge, who is one of the foremost experts on sex abuse internationally. You know, and she says, yeah, there's something about USA Swimming, or swimming in general, and we don't know what that is. But, you know, across the world, it tends to be a sport that kind of draws more of that sexual abuse to it. And whether that's the fact that it's a year-round sport, that there's hands-on time, that there's maybe early morning practices, late night practices, and a lot of times competitive swimming takes you across state lines or on travel meets. And those obviously give all those coaches a lot more alone time with the athletes. So if you have a coach with ill intent, you know, they've got that opportunity.
You mentioned USA Swimming. That's the national governing board for the sport. It certifies and can ban coaches. And in June, the head of it, Chuck Welges, apologized in a blog post for not having done more about the sexual abuse of young swimmers. How did he and how did the organization handle the issue of sexual abuse by coaches in the past?
They didn't, unfortunately. You know, that's kind of the crux of our story, is that for a couple of decades, there just wasn't much done about it. You know, for a long time, there were really no policies in place. And then when there were policies in place, they were neither enforced, and there were no repercussions for if you didn't do anything. So it ended up kind of being this DIY version of, well, we'll figure out when it happens. And a lot of times, he ended up covering those up or not following up on them. You know, one of the things that he talked about is that he wouldn't follow up on rumors. So if he had heard something or there were whispers, he said, you know, I put my hands up and I walk away. And unless a victim actually came to him and said, you know, I have a complaint to file, he wouldn't pursue that. And the problem with sexual abuse cases is that small wisp of smoke that leads to the fire, that's usually all there is. And so to ignore that left a lot of athletes very vulnerable.
I don't know if it's even possible to know, but do you have any idea how many athletes have been sexually abused in swimming?
Oh, no. There's no way to know, because, you know, we have these, you know, we've had, I think the attorneys that I've worked with, they've spoken to at least 100 athletes, if not more. And the problem is these 100 athletes are the bravest of the brave who have come to the point in their life where they're willing to actually come forward. And that's very rare. You know, for female athletes who are abused as children, it can take them an average of 10 years to come forward. With young boys, an average of 27 years.
Yeah.
If they choose to come forward. So, I mean, you multiply that by I don't know how much, and there are many, many children out there who've never come forward.
We invited USA Swimming to come on the program today, and they declined, but they did release a statement about your article. I just want to read a part of it. It says, "We now understand those issues much clearer and have learned to better address the problem of abuse. We've come a long way since 2010. And then it goes on to say that this was a missed opportunity to share how USA Swimming and their parents have now more resources than ever to prevent or stop an abusive situation." And basically said that your story did not give an accurate picture of the organization's current state.
Well, yeah. Well, the current state is in 2010, after 2020 and ESPN exposed the problem, you know, for the first time on a national scale, they started Safe Sport, which was a program that educates and trains, you know, coaches, parents, and eventually athletes to know how to deal with sexual abuse when it comes up. And, you know, when it first began, there were a lot of struggles with that. You know, they're like Anna's case, for example. She gave them a clear statement of abuse. They had their investigators interview people around her, her therapist. But because she would not testify, because they didn't have a signature for her, they wouldn't ban the coach. And so, you know, here's this system that should be working better. And I should say that, you know, in cases when schools have gotten that much information, when they have that clear statement of abuse, they get rid of the person. They don't let them continue coaching, you know. And so I think that's a big problem. There's a lot of problems right now with the National Board of Review and the fact that it is run by the same lawyers who may litigate against those athletes later. So there's a lot of conflicts of interest that are still a really, really big problem. But I will say Safe Sport is getting better and better, but we're still not there yet.
There's an investigation by California Democratic Congressman George Miller into abuse in youth sports, and it was started by him, and now it's being handled by the Government Accountability Office. What can we expect coming out of that?
You know, I think what results, he released a letter a couple weeks ago of, it was a letter that he sent to the FBI asking them to begin engaging USA Swimming, just to begin engaging with them and seeing and digging into this. And I've been told that they are beginning to dig into it. And I think it's going to be a damning report. You know, the letter itself was 4 pages long and detailed really egregious handling of abuse cases. So it's not going to be good. But, you know, that's also to say that USA Swimming, you know, there's a lot of other national governing bodies that are in the same position, but just, you know, haven't had the spotlight.
Rachel Sturts, reporter for Outside Magazine, where you can read her story on sexual abuse and youth swimming. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Parents, do you ever worry about sending your kids off to club sports? Do you find it hard to talk to your kids about these issues? Share your thoughts with us on Facebook at KCRW Press Play, or you can give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up, a change of pace. Our regular Friday film segment will look at three films that tackle serious subjects, one of which is a sleeper called Selma. That's next after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, it is that time of year when we already know pretty much everything about the new releases because they debuted at festivals months ago, besides Dumb and Dumber 2, that is, apparently. Well, I guess they didn't get a cut done in time for Cannes. Here to talk about the movies this week, James Rocky reviews films for The Wrap, Film.com, and others. Welcome back.
Thank you very kindly, Ms. Brand, as ever.
Scott Mance is the film critic for Access Hollywood. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Okay, let's talk about Foxcatcher first. It stars Channing Tatum and Steve Carell. Tatum plays a wrestler, and Carell is the wealthy weirdo John DuPont. And let's play a little clip of tape from an exchange between the two of them.
What do you hope to achieve, Mark?
I want to be the best in the world. I want to go to Worlds and win gold. I want to go to the 88 Olympics in Seoul and win gold.
Good. I'm proud of you.
Ooh, okay, James Rocky, that sounds a little creepy. This is actually a real story.
Yes, Madeline. Directed by Bennett Miller, who made Capote and Moneyball, Foxcatcher is kind of a Venn diagram between those two films about athleticism, money, and true crime. It's about the story of John DuPont, the industrial scion, who, as one of his many hobbies, backed the Olympic wrestling team and entered the sort of patron-slash-patronizing relationship with all of the wrestlers, culminating in him killing Mark Schultz, a brother of David Schultz, two of America's finest wrestlers, in a fit of pique, a bit of anger, misdirected power, who can say? But this is a frosty, Kubrickian, slow burn of a film that is really
Kubrickian.
Yes,
I think that is quite a high bar.
When you look at this movie, where it's all these wintry, locked down, long shots of characters just lost in a wintry frame, you can't help but think of Stanley Kubrick.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. But also beyond that, it's about the performances. Wait till you see Steve Carell in this movie.
You will never believe this is the guy who was the 40-year-old virgin, making his name in comedy like the Anchorman films. You know, he tried drama a little bit in Little Miss Sunshine.
And let's not forget the dingus boss in The Office.
Exactly. Oh, of course. But his physical transformation, he gained weight, wore a prosthetic nose, wore fake teeth. And you would never believe just how insanely great he is. Also Channing Tatum, Mark Ruffalo, who plays Tatum's brother. Also fantastic, unrecognizable. I'm with you on the Kubrickian reference, but I also felt like there was a bit of Fargo in this movie as
It's very cold and cooled down. What's great is that I talked to Mr. Carell, actually, for IndieWire, the playlist, in a great interview, and we talked about how John DuPont isn't that different from Michael Scott. They're both guys with delusions of not just grandeur, but even delusions of competence, the difference being that John DuPont has enough money where you see him as, quote-unquote, eccentric.
And not funny, because this is dealing with murder and control. And
he's very, very funny. He's very, very funny until he is not.
Well, I don't think he's really funny at all. I think he's disturbing. This is an unnerving film, and it's a haunting film that stays with you for days. Not too many movies you could say that about, except maybe Dumb and Dumber. For the wrong reasons, we'll get to that.
We'll get to that, yes.
But regardless, I mean, this is a film that I've really thought of Fargo, but without the Coen brothers' sort of subversive humor.
Yeah, it had the Kubrick cinematography, the sound editing of Altman, and it's a slow burn that just unfolds sublimely.
Okay, it premiered, though, at Cannes in May.
Where it won him, Mr. Miller, the Best Director honors that year, which is no slouch to do at that festival.
So there's no fatigue, buzz fatigue.
No. It played at Telluride, which is where I had the pleasure and the luxury of seeing it, and it opened remarkably well.
It also played at Toronto, where I got to talk to Channing Tatum, and he said that being on set, making this movie, was so intense, his wife joined him and stayed for about a day before she had to leave because she couldn't handle the intensity.
Ooh, okay. Next up, another festival movie, Rosewater. This is Jon Stewart's directorial debut. It's about an Iranian journalist. He's taken prisoner by authorities after, in a meta way, he talks to The Daily Show about life in Iran.
So can you tell me why just journalists meet up with this American spy on the eve of the unrest?
He's not a spy.
He's not a spy?
It's a show.
It's a show?
A comedy show. It's stupid.
It's very stupid, yes.
He's a comedian pretending to be a spy.
So can you tell me why an American pretending to be a spy had chosen to interview you?
And why would a real spy have a TV show?
James, Rocky, what did you think?
This is a very strong film. It's a little over-directed in spots, as Mr. Stewart's directorial debut. At the same time, it has a great sense of humor, which may be the only way to confront some of the more Kafka-esque realities of what the character went through. And the idea of any American director making a film about politics, never mind in America or not, is actually really inspiring. Gael Garcia Bernal plays the Iranian-born journalist who goes back home to talk about the protests for the upcoming election and promptly gets arrested. But this is a movie where the secret police have to pause to call home and say, honey, I'm not going to be home for dinner. I got a really tough interrogation.
So it's a bureaucracy, basically, interrogation.
It's a bureaucracy of interrogation with a lot of absurdity in it. At the same time, it's affecting, it's moving, and it's this very human story about this guy who just wants to get home.
And do you think, though, that this would get as much attention as it's been getting if it weren't Jon Stewart making this movie?
Considering that Jon Stewart could have made any film he felt like Dumb and Dumber 3 or, you know, or Co-Ed Sorority C-SPAN Pillow Fight, the idea that he's using his celebrity and prominence to push a film about a story with this much merit and this much actual meat in it is actually kind of gratifying.
Okay. Now, a sequel... Dumb and Dumber 2, spelt T-O.
Using this address and our superior instincts, you and your little girl are going to be having a family reunion in no time. Cheers!
Whoa! Wait, where'd you get that?
The slurping machine in the back.
That's embalming fluid.
Oh. Does it have aspartame?
No.
Cool.
It's the diet stuff that'll kill you.
Are we laughing at or with or not at all
at
this movie?
Not at all. It's the sequel 20 years after the fact that nobody wanted and, quite frankly, nobody deserved. Listen, the first movie came out in December of 1994, was a big hit, made $250 million worldwide 20 years ago. That's a lot of money then, still a lot of money now. One of the main movies that made Jim Carrey a star after The Mask. But there's something very sad about this obvious cash grab by the Farrelly brothers to make a sequel 20 years after the fact that is not funny, not inspired. It just does not come to life. It's very sluggish. It's like they just went, they followed the money. I have to admit, I did laugh a couple of times because I'm kind of a sucker for potty humor. But does that justify the film? Not at all. I was embarrassed. The Farrelly brothers haven't had a big hit in a long, long time. They've lost their touch. And here's hoping they do not do a sequel to There's Something About Mary.
Well, I have heard at least one critic walked out of a screening. And James, you didn't even bother.
I didn't. Well, the thing is that the Farrelly brothers to me are like the Kardashians. I know they exist, but I don't have to look at them and I don't have to give them money. I mean, when you look at the Farrelly brothers, they make some of the ugliest movies in the world. They don't even know how to hire a cinematographer. They can't even be bothered with the basics of filmmaking. And as Scott said, the prospect of watching, you know, watching people be dumb in their late 20s and 30s, funny. Watching the same people be dumb in their 50s, where it looks like incipient mental illness, kind of sad.
You know,
a little grim.
In this movie, basically, the plot is that Harry, the character played by Jeff Daniels, finds out that he has a daughter, you know, that he was adopted many, many years ago, and he needs a kidney transplant, so he has to go find her. So like the first film, it's a road trip comedy, or at least it's supposed to be a road trip comedy. But, I mean, I just was looking around the room going like, are you kidding me? This is not funny at all.
All the truly great comedies involve life endangering renal failure. It's true.
Okay, so are we pretty much done with Dumb and Dumber?
We're dumb.
Too.
We're done with it.
We're all done with it. Okay. Let's talk about something that's pretty much the opposite. It's a movie that premiered at the AFI Fest this week. It's called Selma, and it covers the event of Martin Luther King Jr.'s marches for voting rights. And I had not heard about this movie. It just kind of snuck up.
It did sneak up, and it snuck up for a great reason, because Martin Luther King Jr. has really never had a movie based, you know, big feature film like this. And David Oyelowo, who is a fantastic actor. He was in The Butler. He played the son of Oprah Winfrey and Forrest Whitaker. He was also in Ava DuVernay, the director of Selma, her last film, Middle of Nowhere. He is a fantastic actor, and he immediately shot to the front runner list for a Best Actor nomination. Also shooting to the front runner list for Best Director is writer-director Ava DuVernay. And if she is nominated, you're looking at a year that could be a milestone in movie history, with two potential Oscar nominees who are women directors, Ava DuVernay and Angelina Jolie for Unbroken.
Which hasn't been released yet.
Hasn't been released, but there's a lot of buzz for it.
What's noteworthy, Ms. Brand, is that they were going to show 30 minutes of Selma on Tuesday at the AFI Fest, and then sort of Oprah and Ava DuVernay said, oh, let's just show all of it. And Ms. DuVernay, introducing the screening, had been up for 38 hours getting the sound edit and color correction done. And when this movie played, it went over extraordinarily well. And I'm not a big fan of hyperbole, but sitting watching Selma, I thought, this is one of the best, if not the best, American film of the year, primarily because it takes the life of a great human being, shows them as a human being, and does not merely demonstrate all of the things they did. It demonstrates how many things we have left undone. In that, this is a movie about voter suppression, which happened in the South for decades before the Civil Rights Voting Act of 1965, and happened as recently as 2 weeks ago. And that this is a movie where people get beaten with baseball bats wrapped in barbed wire trying to exercise a right that 62.7% of a voting populace couldn't be bothered to exercise in the midterms. It is a stirring film about the hard work required to make justice and democracy happen, and I didn't walk out of it feeling like I'd just seen a wax museum or a civics lesson.
So it wasn't your typical overblown biopic that tries to get in every little bit of someone's
life. It very
life.
Wisely, concisely looks at one precise section of weeks and months in his life, and thereby looks at it within that. Bear in mind, as legitimate as your praise is for Mr. Oyelowo, the supporting cast in this is a mile wide and a mile deep. Tom Wilkinson, Tim Roth as George Wallace, Oprah Winfrey as a woman who simply wants to register to vote, Carmen Yoho as a Coretta Scott King, who has an amazing scene opposite David Oyelowo, where they talk about the infidelities that were a real thing that wracked that marriage.
But this is, whenever you have a larger-than-life character like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and you find an actor who humanizes him like he does, like as another example, completely different kind of movie, but the way that, you know, My Week with Marilyn, The way that
Michelle Williams
humanized Marilyn Monroe, that is talent. You know, it's not episodic like this movie could have been, and it's not.
And tell us about the director, Ava DuVernay. She's fairly young.
Ms. DuVernay used to be a publicist for many years and decided that she would rather make her own movies than, you know, talk about other people's, an understandable sentiment in the week Dumb and Dumber 2 comes out. But seriously, she made Middle of Nowhere, which is a great drama about a couple where one of them goes into the prison system and their hard work against that to try and keep things working. It is smart, concise. This is a beautiful. Selma is a beautifully shot film by Bradford Young, the same cinematographer as A Most Violent Year and also Middle of Nowhere. It's a great looking film that is as engaging as it is important.
Well, thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very kindly, as ever.
It's always a pleasure.
Scott Mance, film critic for Access Hollywood, and James Rocky reviews films for The Wrap, Film.com, and others. You guys are great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brand.
And Mr. Olney is here now, Warren Olney himself, to tell us what's
here.
Coming
I'm
up
here
at 1.
To hold forth about our program, which is coming up. We're going to talk about Obamacare. Open enrollment begins again tomorrow. It's going to be going for 3 weeks, 3 months, excuse me. And we will hear that some people probably ought to reconsider it and may want to change, even if they have already enrolled. So they're urged to go to the website. But of course, this occurs in the atmosphere of huge controversy over what has been said by a former consultant about helped to put Obamacare together, about how they deceived the public and deceived the Congress. And there are those who believe that's what really happened and those who don't. We will find out.
Yeah, and the Supreme Court agreeing to take a case.
And more importantly, the Supreme Court has agreed to take it up. There are four little words in the massive document that apparently throw some doubt on whether or not it is legal to provide the subsidies to people. They won't have to give their subsidies back if the court decides that way, but nobody else is going to get them. It's very complicated, but it's very interesting, very important, and I think people will really enjoy our show.
All right, that's coming up in 10 minutes from now, 1 o'clock. Warren Olney, thank you very much. And coming up on this program before that, the city of Donetsk feels like a ghost town. More than a million people have left as Russian tanks and troops are seen crossing the border. That story next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. World leaders always travel with an entourage, but Russian President Vladimir Putin has really outdone himself. He's brought along a phalanx of warships to the G20 summit in Brisbane this weekend. Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott is fuming. He was already furious with Putin over the downing of the Malaysia Airlines plane over Ukraine, apparently shot down by pro-Russian separatists. Meanwhile, in Ukraine, the New York Times is reporting that Donetsk, the capital of the rebel-held eastern region, is turning into a ghost town. Russian tanks have been seen streaming across the border. NATO leaders are worried that that could be a prelude to open warfare. Andrew Kramer has been reporting from Ukraine for the New York Times. He's there now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, just describe what Donetsk looks like now, because you're reporting in the paper today that about a quarter of the population has left.
Donetsk is a town that's mostly deserted in the center part of the city. You hear very loud explosions, sometimes right in the city, sometimes coming from the airport on the edge of town. And shops are closed. Some schools are closed. Restaurants are mostly closed. Now, some people have returned since the fighting in the summertime, only to regret that they did so because the fighting has picked up in spite of a September ceasefire. So it's really not a scene in Donetsk these days. Now, of course, you find people who are very supportive of the pro-Russian cause, who are happy to be, as they see it, free of a right-wing government in Ukraine. But the broader picture is a region with a very uncertain future and many people voting with their feet and leaving.
And where are they going?
Well, about half are going to Russia and half to other parts of Ukraine, according to UN statistics.
And what about these reports that we heard earlier this week of Russian tanks coming across the border? Have you seen that?
When I was in Donetsk last week, I saw military trucks driving on the streets. You often see groups of soldiers, sometimes with the insignia of the rebel organizations, the Novorossiya or New Russia Army, or the Donetsk People's Republic, and sometimes with no insignia or identifying marks whatsoever. And this is the real concern. Observers from the European Union, people of the European Monitoring Organization, the OSCE, say they saw long columns of trucks and men in green uniforms without insignia, raising the possibility that another Russian stealth invasion of Ukraine might be underway, that the green men, the so-called little green men we saw in Crimea, might be on the march again.
Right. And so what's the reaction on the part of NATO, and what can NATO do to prevent that from happening, if anything?
Nothing. There is no military response that's considered by the West, given that Russia is a nuclear armed power, and nobody wants a military escalation in Ukraine. The Western response has been economic sanctions, and that's not a job for NATO.
And in Donetsk, you write in the paper that the people who are leaving are the ones who can leave, the ones who are wealthier, educated, younger. And so the population that's left behind, these are mainly the poor and the elderly?
That's right. It's mostly people who have nowhere else to go, people who don't have the means to leave and, for example, rent an apartment in a Russian city or in another Ukrainian city. It's people who are educated with professions like lawyers or university professors who don't see a future for themselves in this region, who are leaving, and those who are staying are generally the poor and the destitute. And desperate, and this is what the city is comprised of these days.
What was it like before?
It was a large provincial city with an industrial base. Coal and steel were the main industries in Donetsk. It also had a business center, a small skyscraper district, a population of a million. It was a very leafy city that prides itself on its rose gardens, and one of the distinctive elements of Donetsk are the large tailing piles from 19th century mines that look like small hills dotting the horizon around Donetsk.
So what are people saying in terms of if Russia comes in and annexes eastern Ukraine, then what's next? Are they looking further westward? Are they looking for all of Ukraine?
I think the overarching Russian objective is to prevent the consolidation of a pro-Western government in all of Ukraine. In the Russian view of the crisis in Ukraine, they're actually fighting a defensive war. They feel that a balance between Russia and the West that existed in Ukraine before the Maidan protests was disrupted. And the pro-Russian elements in Ukrainian politics were forced out, and that they're now maneuvering to correct this offensive as they see it. And I think the actions in the East are part of that overall strategy create a separatist region that will effectively prevent the consolidation of a pro-Western government.
It would be a sort of no man's land then. It wouldn't be part of Ukraine and it wouldn't be part of Russia. It would just be its own state, eastern Ukraine?
Well, that's the issue. I think the Western mind looks at a problem like this, a separatist region, and wants a resolution. But in the Russian strategy, the problem is the solution. But having this region in a up-in-the-air status for years or decades, as has happened with other separatist enclaves, is really the solution for the Russians to prevent from perhaps joining NATO or joining the European Union.
So that is Vladimir Putin's goal. He has denied, of course, that Russian troops and tanks and trucks are in fact coming across the border.
Yes, the Russians have denied that. It raises the question of where those tanks and trucks might have come from. The goal seems to be creating a separatist frozen conflict in eastern Ukraine. It would really be better for the people in these areas if Russia annexed them and paid pensions and stabilized the economy and provided an outlet for export goods like their steel and coal. The worst outcome for these people is, in fact, an unrecognized separatist state, which is what they have now.
Andrew Kramer reporting for the New York Times in Ukraine. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
It is Friday. Happy Friday to you, Julie Myers.
Happy Friday to you, Madeline.
Thank you.
So in celebration of Friday, we talked about Dumb and Dumber 2, the sequel out this weekend. Critics were not laughing. But I was. I produced the movie segment, as you know, Madeline, and I combed through a bunch of film clips from the movie yesterday, and I laughed out loud at all of them.
You liked the first one.
So there. Loved the first one. Well, some critics walked out of the screening, so we asked you if you've ever walked out of a movie. Personally, Pirates of the Caribbean. That movie is a garbage pile. Hate it. But many of our listeners who really matter weighed in. Carolyn Burns says she wanted to walk out during the trailer for Dumb and Dumber 2. Gina Renee Clark walked out of Howard the Duck. She blames herself, though. She never should have walked in the first place. Rick Biggin walked out of Jackass, the movie. Daniel Gomez-Yata bailed on Anchorman. Michael J. Nice says he has a long list of movies he's walked out of, but most recently it was American Hustle. So he went against critical mass
American
on that movie.
Hustle. Okay.
And Shrim Robertson walked out of the Seth MacFarlane cowboy movie that came out earlier this year. The tipping point was a scene in which Neil Patrick Harris goes to the bathroom in a hat for 3 minutes. Shrim Robertson was not willing to stick around after that.
Perfect way to end the week. Thank you, Jolie Myers.
No problem.
All right. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.